in it. But my recollections are clearest, I think, on the matter of what were we doing, 66 to 67 and 8, in the case of the Federal Field Committee, where I served as chief economist for those years. And then what were we doing, did we think we were doing as professional staffers, technical staffers in the United States Senate when we actually passed the bill. So it's very helpful for me to be able to have that relatively narrow, though eventful, time to make my comments about, and not really have anything necessarily very useful to say of how has it been working out and how do you go repair it if the thing needs repair. Now, in some sense, it's probably this. My own remarks are probably a little more appropriate to the aspirations session, or maybe the U.S. national policy session that follows next week. But I think there would be agreement that the matters of aspirations, and then the mechanisms in the land law settlement, claim settlement, and then the matter of U.S. national policy, are in a way flow together so much that whatever your participation, you're going to be talking oftentimes about the same things. Now, a couple other remarks in positioning what I have to say is it's important probably for each of us that participated at that time to try hard to avoid the mentality of vindication. You know, how was it we were as smart as we really were? Is probably not a terribly useful approach to it. But also, it's equally useful not to take a self-deprecation stance on this of, gee, how did we miss that point? How did we miss some others? How is it that the legislation turned out to be perhaps imperfect? Also, I think it's probably helpful for each of us to avoid the I was there phenomenon as best you can, because I think it's probably more helpful to the review commission if there's if all commentary and remarks are not of the storytelling variety. On the other hand, one shouldn't be too harsh about anecdotal history, because an awful lot of things that happened in with respect to this land claim settlement were not anecdotal in just a storytelling way, but that's how certain concepts were born. That's how certain propositions came about. That's how the kind of pushing and hauling and the malleability of the land claim settlement really came about. So I would not be too harsh on matter of anecdotal history, and so maybe if the panelists once in a while indulge in that, it's not too bad. Another reason for that, I think, is that recall that this was not kind of an adjudicatory matter. This was not of the traditional, if there are such things, court of claims or Indian court of claims activity, but it really was a political settlement in the best sense of small p political, by which I always mean policy settlement. It was a policy settlement. I'm not talking about smoke-filled rooms and what did Nick say to Mike and Ted and so on, but I'm talking about political settlement in the public policy sense. And so that small corner of it that I recall is what I'll want to talk about. One other caveat, if you will, if it doesn't sound too defensive, I think that it's probably also useful to try not to unduly embellish these histories and a person's roles in it. But remember too that if you worry about that, you should also worry about the fact that a person's recollections about something 14, 15 years ago equally much may lose on the forgetting great gaps side as it may be added to by improper embellishment. After all, it was an extremely complicated piece of public policy. At least in the 3 years that I worked in the United States Senate as a staffer, and then five more years at the Congressional Research Service at the Library of Congress, I never saw a piece of legislation more complicated in the sense of technically, and not politically, but technically complicated piece of legislation in defense matters, in public health matters. I never saw one as tough in my small world as this one. Now, my own vantage point then is one of having I've been a co-author of that important document, Alaska Natives and the Land, as Dave Hickok generously mentioned this morning, at the Federal Field Committee. The thing that makes it a little bit more unusual, and I don't claim that it makes for perfect insight, but what made it a little more unusual was that having worked on the Federal Field Committee as we cast up Alaska Natives in the land and the outlines of a proposal of what might be Congress might want to do, is that a couple of years after that, I went to work in the United States Senate as legislative assistant to Senator Gravel. And so from 69 to 72, when I was his L.A., was the exact time that we were being consumed as an office, by passage of the Alaska Native Land Claims Act. So my point there is that I saw it, for whatever the vantage point is worth, from two vantage points. Once from the executive branch, really, as we crafted the Federal Field Committee position, and then from the legislative branch as we crafted the legislation itself. And be aware, naturally, when I talk about a we, this is a collective we that I mean mostly professional staffers in the Senate and the House. But allow me to use we as a shorthand and not a matter of immodesty or something. We're talking about we in that sense. There is perhaps another small advantage, Mr. Chairman, that I have, in that I've not followed the matter since 72, not had anything to do with it, didn't look back on it, had no occasion to, didn't lose interest in it. It's just that that wasn't what I was up to. So I have a reasonably uncluttered recollection of it, and I'm not representing any particular position about it. It's just as best I can, setting out what I thought we were up to. So mine is kind of a Rip Van Winkle stance here of coming back to it, invited back to it some years later. Whether or not that allows more cleanliness of interest in it or something, I don't know. My interest in it is now, I suppose, trying to be accurate about what we're up to, but also what always fascinated me about it as an economist, and a political economist, I guess, as opposed to the more current mathematicians masquerading as economists, was that the public administration aspects of it, the public policy aspects of it, of the settlement, were high interest to me. So when the commission asked me about my participation today, I did the usual things. I reviewed some of the source documents that we worked with over that period, went back to the bill itself, which isn't a bad start, and some of the accompanying legislative history, looked again at our Alaska Natives and the Land, the giant document that it's hard to find now, actually. It's a great big document, as John and others will remember, and served a very, very important function because, as I recall in a crucial moment, Ambassador Goldberg was able to say to the United States Senate, with his hand on the Alaska Natives and the Land, 35-pound document or whatever it was, the analytical and informational work has been done. It's time to settle. And I always thought that whatever arrangement you had with Ambassador Goldberg, that was worthwhile, that one sentence from him, in helping the United States Senate get prepared to do it. I also looked, of course, at the old Field Committee proposal to Senator Jackson, which Senator Jackson had asked us to do on the outlines of the possible legislation. And then finally looked at a few documents that or articles that as I subsequently wrote or published somewhere else. Now, in reading the background material that the commission sent me, the documents I looked at, of course, is the Walt Parker paper, since that's the one that is supposed to be the springboard of our discussion, and we'll use it that way. I also looked at the Reardon paper that was given on opening day, and then I looked at the little backgrounder that the commission sent to all of us as participants and had a point or two to make about that. And then I just thought about it for 4 days and came up and hoped that that's adequate preparation for 3 days of being together and talking about this. Now, a remark on the Fainter-Reardon paper, that on Native aspirations with respect to the Claims Act. I think it's worth making a point or two about other people's aspirations, just to key on that word for a moment, that helped surround what it was going on and help determine what the outcome of the act was. Now, obviously, it's of central importance to go have a paper on what were the aspirations of natives as they came to the native land claim settlement. I'm not talking about that. But I wanted to make the point that there were other aspirations of other very legitimate parties to the settlement. And let me tick off, if you will, a few of what I think were those aspirations and the parties at the time. Of course, they included industry that's been mentioned, and including different parts of industry. Environmental groups were parties to it in various, I think, constructive ways. Non-native Alaskans, obviously, were other persons with aspirations about this settlement. And other Indians around the United States, we were well aware, had interests in and aspirations about the settlement. Certainly the state of Alaska did as government. A governor and of course John Havelock as Attorney General, and the National Administration had aspirations about the settlement at the time. And I mean the White House when I say National Administration at this point, because as many will remember, Mr. Agnew became party to it at one point, not to mention the cabinet offices who kind of obviously would be party to it, like Secretaries of the Interior. Also, other persons with aspirations about the Native Land Claim Settlement included other members in the House and Senate. A guy mentioned Congressman Aspinall, but of course there were others. Senator Kennedy comes to mind, so does Senator Harris, persons who played particular roles in the shaping the outcome. Another set of persons that had aspirations about the Settlement Act were professional staffers themselves of the committees and of the delegation, that is the Alaska delegation. And by aspirations here, I'm not talking about career aspirations, and I'm not talking about something in it for the staff, but I mean aspirations in the sense of all of us acting qua professional staff. You know, how do you behave in trying to participate in as a member of a House or a Senate office in shaping this legislation. So that aspiration is very, very important part of it as well. And so I think it's especially good that John Havelock and Bill Van Ness and Guy Martin and myself, I'd like to have seen John Katz, because he was Senator Stevens, L.A., during this time, was a very, very important participant from the point of view of professional staff aspirations about the settlement. And I think a knowledge of and some recollection of all these aspirations is probably useful for you in session three anyway on U.S. national policy, and maybe now as you look to these 1991 dates and so on that is to be worried about. So my remarks then center almost entirely on the professional staffers' reflections on this. And the legitimacy of those varying interests. That is, it was legitimate that all these parties that I mentioned would be here. Now, a point about professional staff. Recall that immodesty is required in any policymaking, really, unless you believe that what the policymaker is to do is just be a reactor to how many battalions can this group muster and how many battalions can that group muster. If you think policymakers only should just kind of be pulled and hauled and stumble through to an outcome entirely in a responsive mode, then that is, of course, one view of policymaking. That isn't mine. Mine is that policymaking, called whatever it is not a matter of just following, but it does involve a certain immodesty. And the immodesty, frankly stated, is that you know better, that what you're up to, and with goodwill and good intentions, and as well-informed and smart as you can be, that in a sense you know better, or at least maybe even best. Another part of technical staff, though, is just that, technical. That the thought was that you're supposed to be fairly expert about these matters, and certainly the attorneys participating from the committee staffs, the most distinguished one being Bill Van Ness, I would say, from the Senate side, clearly, and Guy Martin and John. It was very, very professional as technical staff, acting as experts in the design of this thing. But staff also act not just as experts, but also as consensus builders, because and you'd be annoyed if it was any other way, certainly. One can't always see the principal. One can't always see the senator or the congressman. Sometimes you deal with the rest of us during that period. And so we were not only a forum and a conduit, you will recall, but we certainly weren't totally passive. We were also not brokers. I don't want to make it too harsh, but we were consensus builders in a way, having to do, for purposes of this discussion, with the various components that became the Alaska Native Land Claims Act. Now, let me turn a moment, a remark or two, on the background description of the overview hearings, the piece that I received, that we all received from the commission itself. A couple points there. In that little write-up, it's a very good write-up, but there is a sentence that says, very early on, that talks about the principles of freedom and diversity and the rule of just law, and the write-up says, that were said to underlie the Alaska Native Land Claims Act, and then goes on and talks about de Tocqueville's unease and worry and so on. It may be too defensive on that, but it seemed to me that word choice, said to underlie freedom, diversity, just law, said to underlie the Claims Act, was a little bit suggestive of that maybe it really doesn't underlie. And I think that, again, without being too defensive about it, I feel entirely sure that freedom, diversity, and the rule of just law, in fact, are the principles that underlie that legislation. And I would say the uneasiness that is talked about in the write-up has more to do with the taxation and the stock transfer matter and various possible changes in what could be described as preferential treatment is what really is the basis of the unease, and not whether the it was a just and freedom rule. After all, when you're facing major decisions, as the next years require, that's always unpleasant. It's always uncertain. It's always tension-ridden. It's choice making always is difficult, and of course. It's something that one would rather not do in personal life or in public life much of the time. And yet that's exactly what was contemplated, I would argue, in the design of the settlement itself. Anxiety-inducing, stressful period of making hard choices about what you wanted to do is just what, in my view, was intended and always contemplated. Because risk and opportunity always are stressful things. Because what we were trying to do there was consciously avoid a womb approach of endless trust, of substituting a law firm wardship or a consulting firm wardship for a BIA wardship or a federal wardship was what we were trying to avoid. Those histories aren't all that admirable of the other kind. And so we were trying to, and I'll make this point several times in different ways, we were trying to get away from that. And so the special tax avoidance matter that was written into the bill, and that's all right, you know, we have, the society is riddled with subsidized arrangements and preferential treatments. That's all right. But we didn't have in mind that it would be a forever special preferential treatment. This kind of tax avoidance. So what you face, I think, is a very, very healthy prospect and ought to be viewed that way, despite the acknowledged painfulness that that is associated with it. Now, another point on that write-up. There is a phrase that talks about, and it's reciting concerns that people have. It's not taking a stance in this little write-up, but it says native land is a worry that native land resources of falling into non-native hands. Well, you know, I suppose that there are ways to worry about that, and it may be a proper worry, but this is a worry, of course, that's talked about when the assets become tradable and transferable. Well, you know, this smacks slightly, in my view, of losing China to the communists, or Lebanon to the the Christians lost Lebanon to the Muslims. I mean, what are we talking about? We're talking about, of course, land might and resources might fall into non-native hands. It seemed to me that phrase, depending on what's behind it, is not a is an alarmist phrase that that isn't all that that helpful. Because the little write-up goes on to say these concerns are not unfounded, so it seems to take a stance there. It seemed to me that that belies a very different view of the settlement than some of us had in mind when the idea of the possibility of alienating, as the attorneys say, assets into non-native hands was exactly the possibility that we had in mind. That possibility would be rooted on something that could be variously described, and one is normalcy, normal commercial behavior, a movement toward business as usual, a movement toward providing a sameness for the native population in terms of the legal recognition and treatment that it had. That is, being like everybody else. That has got nothing to do with, I don't think, with cultural traditions and this and that, but in part of one's life, it's important to be like everybody else. And the part that it's important to be like everybody else, it seems to me, is the legal entitlement part and the recognition of that that stature. So what I'm calling in as neutral a term as I can, kind of normalcy, business as usual, in my view, was one of the goals of what we were trying to do. And the other, another phrase in that little write-up that we had talks about the loss of Alaska Native control over their land. And that's all right, that's a proper description, but one should remember that the other side of that, properly done in the transaction, is a gain of money or income or value received for the loss of Native control over some land. So I think it's a maybe a trite point, but it's important to recall that transactions are two-sided when they're properly and willingly entered into, and so a transaction consummated is inherently two-sided, and the loss of native land control, whatever the grim implications of all that may be, is countered by a gain of something, presumably money, income, other kinds of assets. Now, there are also some quotes from former Congressman Meeks and his role with the Indian Policy Review Commission, and he describes American policy as laws were piled upon laws without regard to the effect of one upon the other. Well, I don't think that accurately describes what we were up to anyway in crafting the Alaska Native Land Claims Act. We're very, very sensitive to not piling laws upon laws and not looking broadly at what it was that we were doing and what some of the implications might be. Indeed, worried a great deal about the implications, knowing that there would be some for Maine, as there subsequently has been, and for Oklahoma, and indeed for Canada, and whatever the other places are that I've since lost track of, where the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement has been a force. So we were well aware that this wasn't just a little item between Senator Jackson and the Alaska Native community. It was a great big thing that had wide, wide implications that we knew about. We knew we were doing precedential, not presidential, but precedential things, certainly within the U.S. and even internationally. We were very conscious of past settlements, and they are often bad and even sad outcomes. So Meade's description of U.S. Native relationships as, quote, never been implemented by a consistent, coherent policy, end of quote, was what we were trying not to do. I think that, again, without making it sound like a celebration of the beauty of the Alaska Native Land Claims Act, because don't charge me with that, but I just say that that I do not think that it's fair to say that it was inconsistent and didn't have a coherent policy throughout it, and certainly underpinning it. So I think the former congressman's assertions there were not fair. As you see, I'm using some of these points as a springboard to make a point or two. Well, now, on to the Packer paper, because, you know, academics as others, I guess, when you get a paper and you're asked to be a discussant, you read the paper carefully and you avoid telling the writer the good things he said or she said, and then you kind of zero in on the ones you want to whack at a bit. An important one remark in the Parker paper is that land tenure and resource control was the focus of the land claims bill, which indeed it was, at the expense of something Walt seems to describe as other aspects of natives functioning in the society. Really kind of implying that the legislation finessed or attempted to finesse all these other aspects. And all these other aspects, I gather from some of our conversations of this morning or other panelists, include things like what we'd call the social dimensions, probably health and services and education and so on. And I think that that may be slightly unfair. You can quarrel about how much emphasis was there on this or that, but I think that's slightly unfair that it ignored the other aspects. Because after all, remember what we were trying to do. We were trying to extinguish a claim, and we devised the notion to do it with a combination of land and money. And the implication of that was that good things would subsequently happen, because good things generally do happen with abundant land and money. Now, I noticed the Reardon paper makes the point that suicides and educational attrition and some of these bad statistics have perhaps not changed unduly, but she also fairly makes the point that that wasn't central to the Alaska Land Claims Act. I mean, how much do you ask of public policy when you're trying to settle that kind of claim? On the other hand, I think that the Parker assertion there that it was at the expense of other aspects is still only partly true, because those mechanisms that we chose of how the land was allotted and the money provided were really rooted themselves in what I think we were trying to accomplish in a social engineering way. Byron mentioned a synonymous phrase, I think, earlier today, a social experiment, and that's right. We were really doing some social engineering, I would say as well, because we were trying to accomplish some things socially. We were trying to accomplish some things individually, that is, for individual natives and not just collectively, and that's why we had a mix of things that had to do with individuals and things that had to do with collectivism. The reason that we did things statewide in certain proportions was so that one community wouldn't unduly gain a windfall by happening to fall into it in some fashion with respect to resources. So there's a whole lot of things, devices that were crafted in that act that I think, Walt, could fairly be described as pointed toward social, individual, and attitudinal changes. And I'm thinking the private corporation matter and the financial experiences matter have to do with attitudinal changes that we were hoping to accomplish, and maybe even some cultural ones. After all, if you look at the land arrangements with respect to villages, and then when we put on that land selection for economic potential, and then we say, well, what about hardships? Yeah, let's have one in there for hardships and selection, and then see what about subsistence use, right? And we worked one in for subsistence use. I think that is surely it's land oriented, money oriented, but I think was trying to get at some other things. And I would mention the ratios. I can't remember if it stuck in the final bill, but recall that we had a ballooning feature, I believe, where money is flowing into the compensation side would go in a fashion that allowed them to be placed in particular ratios and in early time, so that people presently living had access to some goodies from the settlement and so on, legitimate arrangements. Also, the stock shares matter and health and services. And recall it on specifically, if that's what we're talking about, Walt, on health and services, I think it is so that there were some amendments lying around that had to do with changing the relationship of public health service and the BIA to Alaska Natives in the course of this settlement. And I remember that was a raging controversy at that moment. And if you look at, as I reread the legislative history, there the write-up seems to go to great lengths in saying, now, this is, be aware that whatever we do here is not to be conceived of as a backing away by the feds. This is the term maybe even used for the first time then, was a bugging out by the federal government, I recall, by writing in whether or not there might be some changes of the on the relationship of the Public Health Service to and BIA to natives. And it had to do, at least our motivation, what had nothing to do with bugging out. It had to do with wondering if it was worth reopening the question of whether a racially based health service and dentistry and so on is the best way to do it forever. And that was fought back, as I recall it. And the legislation quite often says, no, we don't, no one's bugging out. And I noticed that my good friend and colleague John Havelock today made to me a startlingly strong statement about how he feels that the federal participation and obligation is continues to be as much as before, and I don't know, maybe more. Now, even though we said throughout the legislation that nothing in this was to change and so on, it was certainly true that there was some relation between the settlement of money and land and what the presumption was about the necessary long-term federal concern for Alaska Natives. The idea was that, you know, if you put up $500 million initially, and $500 million more in royalties and revenues, and land that, you know, unless it's a terrible ill luck of the draw, some good things are going to happen. And those good things that are going to happen could mean that the need for longer-term federal relationship and participation might be a little bit less with good luck than it would otherwise be. In fact, some of the support, the arguments for support for the legislation had to do with convincing senators and congressmen that this was a cost-effective way of attending to legitimate social and economic needs of Alaska Natives. And it was a better way, in fact, to do it this fashion than it was to forever get bogged down into annual BIA appropriations and health service appropriations for this or that. I remember a good bit of the argument getting outside support for the settlement turned on that. And recall that the settlement didn't have to be land and dollars. You know, one always starts with whatever it is that worked out and that's the base. But it didn't have to be that. It might have been just land. And in my view, the reason it was dollars also was that we wanted to get a fairly quick chance at some improvements, some better things happening, in addition to paying off for what was a legitimate claim settled in a political fashion. There even was, I think, some views among the staff that land and dollars were somehow substitutable over some range. We probably misjudged the fierceness with which the Native community cared about the land portion of the settlement being as much as it could be. And the not lack of interest in the dollars, but I think we probably misjudged a bit that as best you can talk collectively about the Native community, and I know all the difficulties with that generalization, that still we probably misguessed that land was as central and not very substitutable for dollars as we maybe thought they might be. Recall that the Times, and different of my colleagues here have mentioned it, and it isn't just a rhetorical point, that the times here were times of the 60s where upward mobility was the theme, economic development was a rampant national theme. It was a theme that was used throughout this legislation, the passage of the legislation, and the Walt Parker article paper as well as the Reardon paper makes this same point, that those were very much uppermost on persons' minds of upward mobility, reducing barriers to upward mobility for minorities of all kinds, and it was in that tradition that an awful lot of this took place. It was not just a matter of commercial development would be held up for Sohio or somebody. That was vastly overplayed, in my view, as the occasion for settlement. So the other side of that is that that time doesn't come too often where you have that confluence of forces where it's ripe to go do something in a major, major way as the settlement did. Indeed, as a lot of you and certainly I think most of us worried about, the thing could have unraveled pretty fast if it had not been able to be moved through when it was, because not everyone still believes in all of that. And Alaska can't always be in front of the Congress with what is viewed by others as special pleading. Now, Wal Parker writes that the natives thought the settlement involved sovereignty from the feds to themselves and didn't really realize that the sovereignty switch was from the feds to the state. Again, maybe a small quarrel at the margin, but I would say if that wasn't realized, that would be a bit strange, because the state of Alaska was central to so much of the settlement that it would be seems to me a bit odd if one didn't notice that one of the concepts involved was to move this relationship out of the federal arrangement into something that's closer to and more recognizable to most of the citizenry, and that is state government. And so these the institutions that were talked about of fee simple and private corporation, right, that's just as we had in mind using institutions that were common and recognizable and with long histories and understandable, like those two, complicated as John Havelock properly points out they are to teach corporations and maybe even fee simple, still we wanted easily identifiable, readily understandable institutions having to do with the state. And also, the state of Alaska, I believe, was among other compromises it made in the course of that settlement. The state was aware that it was quite likely that most of the second $500 million was to come from the state of Alaska and not from some other place. So the state has, in my view, a proper and legitimate role in the sovereignty matter. I would, as an opinion, I would myself not like to see people searching for new sovereignty arrangements, especially of the tribal variety, as an opinion. Now, Walt Parker says in his paper that with respect to the fee simple ownership and the private corporation form of institutional arrangement, that this was, quote, happenstance and lack of better alternatives. I thought that was a curious word choice. I'd say it was mostly because of lack of better alternatives, that is, these were the best alternatives, and that it wasn't happenstance at all. I mean, happenstance to me means something a lot more casual than the agonizing we did over dreaming up something that was, I think, as inventive as the one that we did. Now, both of these institutions did, that is, fee simple and private corporations, did place the state at center stage in this, and that is again something that I think we had in mind. Now, Walt says also in his paper, and this is maybe one I should just pass over, but you describe the problem of Congress being hoisted on its perennial petard because what is done in one state, as seen by the Congress, has to apply to all. Now, I don't think that is being raised on one's petard. That's the way you do it. That's the point of the system. And indeed, I would argue, unless it's a word choice matter that we're quarreling about, that it would be an awful arrangement if there wasn't uniformity and standardization of this sort. Now, let me elaborate on that. I think that there was a very widespread feeling in 69 to 72 that it was time for Alaska, not Alaska natives, but Alaska, to back away a bit from what was seen by many as an undue number and amount of special pleadings. The uniqueness argument, which has been so skillfully used by Alaska and political people in Alaska, to see to the flow of monies from the U.S. Treasury in various programs and all, very, very adroit and skilled thing. But and you have to be aware that if you come in with a land claim settlement and someone starts stocking $500 million to start with and $500 million more and other assets like $44 million in land, that some legitimate parties to the matter wonder, and this is not a pork barrel matter, they wonder if maybe the numbers and the frequency of the special case for Alaska gets to be counterproductive and maybe hurtful. Now, when the settlement finished up, my recollection of some of the executive sessions there in the United States Senate, and not to breach those sessions, but my recollection was that most senators around the table basically felt that while it wasn't quite a one-shot thing, that as a practical matter, they weren't keen on hearing many more great big proposals that come in from the state of Alaska, and I say that as I mentioned, as a legislative assistant to one of the senators at that time, and there was I think widespread understanding that that was the notion. Now I'm aware that senators change, and they surely do in Alaska, and that the personnel around the committees and so on change, and so maybe that isn't an encumbrance anymore, especially after 20 years. Maybe it's Alaska's turn again, but I mention it as a part of it. My own thought was on this special case matter, just to one other whack at that, is that when I was with the Federal Field Committee and subsequently, was that good public policy for the nation is to have Alaska, as soon as possible, be just another sister state. And the differentness notion changed to a sameness notion. I'm not talking about beauty and all that, but on the matter of how it's viewed and how it gets treated in a macro policy sense, it's a much better goal nationally to have Alaska take its place as just another state. And not everything that has to do with the Congress and the executive branch with respect to Alaska be a great emergency or viewed as a special pleading. So I always thought that was an important goal. Now, Walt mentions in his paper, a little more specifically here, about this tricky problem of whether to alter the current arrangements as you get toward the tradability of assets and transferability of assets. And I really am not up on what the current arguments within the state are on that. I suspect there are more than two sides in talking about this. I certainly agree it's a great big subject proper for discussion and vigorous debate. And Walt mentions in his paper what seemed to me to be some notion that maybe a refederalizing would be a good idea. Now, if refederalizing means anything like I think it means, I think it's a bad idea. I think that would be unfortunate if we came this far in moving toward normalcy, what I'm calling normalcy, and in a way that is helpful to get the federal involvement to be less.